Welcome back to my loyal students. This is the third year that we've had these classes. Some of you are tried and true members of this august Chetus. Anyway, so I thought, let's look at the Creed. And the first article of the Creed concerns God the Father. We can write it out just for combination of visual and auditory learning. These markers are all dying. And no one ever throws out markers. This is the Nicene Creed. We recite it in Mass every Sunday and on solemnities. I believe in God the Father Almighty. Let's get the accurate maker of heaven and earth, of all things visible and invisible. So let's start with the word God. Because this is the first thing that we say we believe in. I believe in one God. Let's start with the word God. What does God mean? What's the meaning of the word God? Well, St. Thomas Aquinas gives us one when he talks about proving the existence of God in the beginning of the Summa Theologiae. He calls it the nominal definition of God. Because if you're going to prove that something exists, you have to know what you're talking about, right? What kind of thing meets that standard or that goal? And his nominal definition I like. I think it's helpful. He says, by the word God, we mean a provident creator of the universe. And by universe, basically this is just omnia, right? All of it is. All things, maker of all things. And so when we ask people, or people ask us, do you believe in God? Basically, this is what we're asking. Do you believe in a provident creator of the universe? Do you believe that a source of all things exists? And when we say, I believe in God, or I believe that God exists, this is what we're saying, that the universe comes from a being who is its principle and who somehow governs it, right? To be provident is basically to govern, to guide it to an end, to guide things to their good or their end. Now, where do we get belief in God, right? To say, I believe in God. Where does this come from? What are the sources of our belief in God? Well, there are two traditional sources, one and two. Obviously, the Creed is a summary of what? What's the first source we could talk about? What does the Creed summarize?
Revelation.
Revelation. Very good. Jeff, you're going to... You might not have to take the midterm if you keep going this strong.
You can just
pass right out of the midterm. Very good.
All right. Revelation.
And so, you know, there's two sources of revelation, sacred scripture and tradition, and the church's magisterium is the definitive interpreter and protector of the what's called the deposit of faith. And the Creed is a summary of that deposit of faith. And so in Revelation, it's revealed what, among other things, that such a being exists. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in the Creed. If this wasn't a revealed truth, it wouldn't be in the Creed because the Creed is a summary of Revelation. And so when God reveals himself to Israel through the patriarchs and the prophets, the kings, when God becomes incarnate in Jesus Christ, this God who is revealing himself to us and to the holy people is the one true God. That's who he claims to be, the creator of all that is, right? The one provident creator of the universe itself. And so part of the content of what he reveals about himself is that this is who is revealing, okay? This is the real being who enters history to reveal himself in the deposit of faith. And who establishes the church. Now, very importantly, especially for this first article, reason is another source for the truth that God exists. human reason, in principle, unaided by grace, can also establish the truth of belief in the existence of God, that there's one provident creator of the universe. Without revelation, without an explicit appeal to faith, one can come to know simply by using your mind that God exists. This happens, I think, in two basic ways.
They're both kind of obvious or well-known, but
one is what we can call like natural religiosity, natural religion,
or these are kind of related, kind of common sense,
that there's something about our mind which kind of naturally comes to the conclusion that there has to be a transcendent source of the real that we're in contact with, this world that we live in. And that is that's reflected not just in the monotheistic religions, but also in all religions. Because if you study comparative religions, especially those that believe in, that focus on gods, usually there's like one god that's like really more god than the others, right? So there's always an anthropologist talk about this too when they study religion. There's a kind of background monotheism, even in polytheistic religions, that the more you trace religion back historically, the more and more monotheistic they become. And polytheism is a kind of degradation or corruption of an original polytheistic religion. So there's like the sky god, who's the most important, or Zeus or Kronos, right, for the Greeks. There's always a kind of hierarchy, and there's one god who's like more really god, more responsible for the way things are than others. The second one would be what? Yes, Ms. White, huh?
Nature, the book of nature?
Yeah, but what is that called? How do we access it?
Through our senses.
Yeah, but what does it? What discipline? That's right. That's all right. Nature, it's nature. But this is nature too, right? Like you get out there, you're one guy told me, this guy, I can't remember what country he was from, but he was African, and his grandfather was an important linguist, and they had no word for atheism in his dialect. And he said, so his grandfather coined a word for atheism for his tongue, and it was weak-mindedness of the white man. Which I thought was fantastic, right? It's like, well, white mental illness, you know, that you would possibly somehow think that God doesn't exist, right? That, you know, the things just grew up out of the ground without any, you know, all this happens just by accident, right? Without any God, divine origin or divine guidance. So yeah, nature, philosophy, very good. So these are the philosophical philosophy, what we call the philosophical proofs, rational arguments for God's existence. And as we just heard, these begin with our experience of the sensible world that we live in. Or some of them actually also start with just experience of thought. Whether they're as good is another question. In both cases, they start from creation, from thinking about and being in contact with creation, and moving by argumentation to establish that there has to be some transcendent divine cause of the things that are. This actually is another cool thing. So just like we know this, it's hard to explain what's cool about it, but I believe in God, a provident creator of the universe, is revealed, even though it's also accessible to reason. But what's also revealed is that the existence of God is accessible to reason, which is pretty cool. God reveals to us in the Bible, and the church teaches it, that human nature, and specifically the human mind, can come to a certain knowledge of God's existence. This is taught dogmatically in Vatican Council I. Here's the short quote. from Vatican Council I at the end of the 19th century. The one true, it's a very powerful language. The one true God, our Creator and Lord, can be known with certainty by the light of human reason from things that are made. All right, this is in St. Paul. It's also in the wisdom literature in the Old Testament. Which I always thought was kind of neat, that God reveals to us something that, not only something that we can know on our own, but that we can know it on our own. And so he gives confidence to our ability to know him, even without his help, right? Which is kind of neat. Now, Thomas Aquinas takes this a step further, which is very interesting. I just discovered this summer. And yeah, in an explicit way. Maybe it was implicit somewhere. So this relationship between reason and revelation and our ability to know God, Thomas Aquinas says our natural ability to know God is at the ground of the possibility for receiving revelation at all. In a way that's understandable. This is all themes that you find in Fides Oratio, sure. So basically, Thomas says the possibility of revelation, right? The very possibility of knowing God through faith, right? That supernatural power to know him, right? By revelation, depends on our natural ability to know him. Not necessarily that we know him naturally, but our capacity to know him naturally, which is kind of neat. Why would that be the case? Well, because unless this word God, right, if the word God didn't make natural sense, then when God showed up and said, hey, I'm God revealing things about me, myself to you, isn't this special? We'd be like, what are you talking, right? It'd be like gibberish. It wouldn't only be like, some people use the example, well, if you had to describe colors to a blind person, that would be really hard. I think it'd be more like describing colors to a blind dog, right? Talking to the dog about, you know, what red is like or orange. So it's just, you know, there's no ability to communicate unless in the recipient of the communication, there's some connection, right? There's some intellectual connection. And so if God showed up and said, I'm the one true God, right? Like he does to Abraham and Moses and all those people who created heaven and earth. And we had no conception that there could be such a thing or that we could know that made any sense. Well, then revelation wouldn't have any hold in our soul. Because this knowing God through faith is not just a supernatural thing, but it's a thing that builds on our nature, right? Grace perfects and presupposes nature. And so unless we had a natural ability to know God without grace or faith, having that help of grace or faith would be no help at all because there'd be nothing to help, which I found kind of interesting. So it's good to do philosophy because it kind of strengthens your natural capacity to understand revelation. It strengthens like your God muscles. Yes.
Is that just building on we're made in the image of God?
Yes. I think that's where it comes from, right? Really what it's building on for Aquinas is the universality of the mind and the will. That's where he bears down on it metaphysically. Basically, he says in this one article, he says human nature has an immediate ordering to God because our minds are open to the universal, right? All things. And since God is the principle of all things, we have an immediate ordering to the principle of all things because our minds are open to knowing all things. And basically, to know all things is at least in principle to be able to know the cause of all things, which is kind of cool. So it's the immateriality, universality of our knowledge, which can step outside of the whole, right? This is like
created being, and God creates it all. But we have this special ability because of reason to be able to kind of like step outside of it and reflexively think about the whole. And in thinking about the whole, we also have the capacity to surmise that it needs some source or principle. And so this openness of our mind, especially, right, the intellect, the openness or the ordering of the intellect to omnia, to all that is, gives us an ordering also to the principle of all that is, right, God. And without that, faith wouldn't make any sense because unless this was happening, when he comes down and says, hey, here I am, it would be like, here, who is? doesn't make any sense at all, right? It would be inexplicable. Faith wouldn't be understandable. Okay. Any questions besides the one that we had? Great. Now, that said, strong language from Vatican II, Vatican I, we can repeat that real quick. The one true God, our Creator and Lord, can be known with certainty by the light of human reason from things that are made. Now, nevertheless, even though he's known with certainty, it's a limited knowledge. So just because we can know him without the light of faith or with our own natural ability doesn't mean that that's sufficient. And so it's characterized by theologians, Thomas Aquinas among them, as a kind of negative knowledge. So the natural knowledge of God is intrinsically limited. Aquinas would say we know that he is, but not what he is in himself. Why? Because when we know God naturally, we only know him through his effects. And so we can know certain things about what he has to be like, but we don't know him directly. So it's kind of like this, right? If all you knew about my hand was by deduction from the fact that there has to be something there holding up this, whatever it is, cocktail napkin. Well, then you know some things about my hand, right? That it has a certain size or mass, or maybe you could feel it. Oh, it's a little soft there. It's got some ridges. But you couldn't know that it's like this, right? Because you only know it through the effects that it's producing in the napkin, okay? So it's the same thing with natural theology. Natural theology is to know God as cause, but not in himself. That gets us somewhere, right? That he exists. We can know that he exists, that he's all-powerful, that he's all-knowing. But many of the things we know about God in this way are negative, right? Infinite, not finite. We don't really know what that means. We only know that it's not like the things that we're used to, okay? Uncaused. Again, we don't really know what that means. We only know that it's not like the things that we have direct contact with in our ordinary existence. Eternal. Again, that's negative, right? It means non-temporal, not in time. So these are kind of negative attributes. And so this is important, and saints and theologians are constantly kind of hammering this home that we know less about God than we know about God, and God is less like creation than he is like creation. God is more different from his creation than he is similar to his creation. And so we get phrases, very nice phrases from like St. Augustine, who says, if you can grasp it, it's not God, right? Sorry. Right? St. Augustine. I don't know who came up with this one, but St. Ignatius of Loyola liked it. Deus semper maior, right? God is always greater, right, than anything there is or anything you can conceive, right? God is always, always beyond, always greater. And then, of course, there's St. Anselm of Canterbury. God is that than which nothing greater can be conceived. I hope I got that right. Something like that.
And so if you can think of anything and you can think of something a little bit better, well, then what you're thinking of is not God. It's always better. It's kind of a more formal statement of these two, right, with regard to thinking about God. Okay. Yeah.
I'm trying to tie together the notion that the natural knowledge of God is limited, and yet we know from it that those three things you wrote up, that he exists, he's all-powerful, and all-knowing.
Right.
I can understand he exists, but how about the all-powerful and all-knowing?
Yeah, so this takes philosophical argumentation. I'm just positing these things as fait accomplis. But, so all-powerful, Aquinas would say, if you understand what creation is, we're supposed to get to that. If you understand what creation is, that it's to make something out of nothing. Aquinas thinks that non-change, I was going to talk about this, it's not actually a change, but that transition from nothing to something, presupposes infinite power. The other thing you do here is what you do is, how does this work? One of the proofs for God's existence is that we'll say that in finite things, there's always a composition of act and potency, or act and potential, and then the argument goes up to God, who is pure act, right, and infinite act. And so from there, if he's infinite act, he's infinite power. If he's the source of intelligible things, he's knowing, and there's nothing that limits his knowledge. And so once you get God's infinity and his simplicity, which are kind of connected, that nothing from the outside can limit God, well, then you get the sense that any positive aspect that he has to be maximal, right? Does that make some sense?
It does, and this all flows from natural knowledge as opposed to revelation.
Yes, it's all revealed too, but that would be a way of getting at
revelation
it.
Revelation isn't required, isn't necessary.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. That's right, yeah. Yeah, at least on Aquinas' view. With natural theology, you can establish that God exists, that he's all-powerful, that he's all-knowing, and several other divine attributes.
So, okay, first question is, the negatives, am I right? I'm so grateful you asked this. Are the negatives, that's sort of the first step, that you're like, we can tell by reason there's an uncaused cause, right? But then once we know he's uncaused, then you walk us through, and then that's when we get to ultimately an uncaused cause has to be all-powerful. But it's sort of...
Well, I don't know if you start with a negative, because... what do you start with? There has to be a cause of finite being,
okay,
right? From different starting points, and as a cause of finite being, and especially if it's a creative cause, well, then that cause has to be like this and not like that, or that cause has to be different from the things that it made. Because if it weren't different in these ways, it would be another thing that needs to be made, right? And so the first thing is the act of causation. And then from there, what kind of attributes must this cause have, given that he's the cause of the things that are in our experience? Does that make sense?
It does. I guess I'm hung up because I'm, you know, when you were saying we can only know the negations, it reminded me of my high school theology about... Precisely.
Why did I say we can only know the negations? I said it's heavily negative.
Okay. Second question.
Yeah.
And would you say still with reason alone we could get to all good? Like with the...
Yes.
...gentles are evident enough. Okay, great.
Yeah. Yeah, you can get to all... Well, for Aquinas, you can get to all good. Yeah, he does it in question 5. Okay. Great. Good questions. And so this keeps us, you know, we're always like between, hey, we're pretty special,
But, you know, stay humble, right? And so to know God well is not to think that he's just another thing that we have the power to know. And so these kind of formulations of his transcendence help to keep us in a state of humility, of awe, reverence, right, wonder, even though we have this natural ordering or natural ability to relate to him, okay? And the more you know, the more you truly know, the more humble and more reverent and more sense of wonder you'll have, okay? The more you really reflect on God well. All right, let's move to creation. That was, I believe, in God. We'll skip Father Almighty for now. Maker, creator of heaven and earth, of all things visible and invisible. The act of creation is very interesting for Thomas and, well, for Christianity in general. Because as we said before, it's ex nihilo. God creates the universe, right? Everything else that exists. Ex nihilo, out of or presupposing, I can't spell anymore. It's the, you know, it's the phone. How do you spell presuppose? Is it two P's?
I think so.
One S, two P's? Presupposing, yeah, that's it. Anything. Wait, not presupposing anything. Out of or presupposing nothing. Now, a cool thing that Aquinas says about this that helps us to understand what this means, ex nihilo, is that he says creation is not a change. The act of creation is not a change. Why?
Because a change is always from potency to act, but for there to be potency, there has to be something. So it's like cosmically, like a change.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So it's bigger than a change. Like, change is not large enough to describe it, because change is, you're at the top of the hill, you have the potential energy, you roll down the hill, there's a change. You have a piece of paper, which has the potency to burn, you light it on fire.
That's right. And so,
like, nothing to something.
Right, so if there's potency here, there's not nothing here. And so the way Thomas will describe it is that's almost too good of an explanation. The way Thomas will describe it is that all changes presuppose some subject that undergoes the change, right? All changes presuppose a subject that undergoes the change and not just the external cause of the change. And so for Thomas, a change is like if I change from somewhat tan, which I'm not, to pale in a couple months, well then what underwent the change is me, right? Or more specifically, my complexion, right? Or if your daughter studies here and she goes from being ignorant to a little bit less ignorant, well, then she's the subject of that change, right? That gain of knowledge. Or the stuff that's in the tree, right? If you burn down a tree, some of the material stuff that the tree is made of or constituted of becomes ash and others is released as smoke, right? And others kind of becomes energy, however that works, right? So, in any change, you have some subject that, in a certain sense, is the same before and after the change. And so when the church says creation ex nihilo, nothing is nothing. This is an absolute sense of nothing. There's nothing there to change. So what happens with creation is that first there's just God. And then after creation, there's God and other things. Another way of saying it is that he doesn't take nothing and change it into something because there is nothing there to take or to be changed. A corollary of this, if you understand that he doesn't presuppose anything or do something to anything when he creates, a corollary or a
consequence of this is that God has to continue giving existence to whatever is not God. Right? God has to continually give existence to whatever is not God. And so we distinguish between creation. When we say creation, many times what we're referring to is the first moment of a previously non-existent worlds or things existence, right? That first moment of creation. But conservation is basically the same activity, but just extended in time. Right? This is called divine conservation. Divine conservation is God's continued granting of existence to the same world or thing.
So thank you for that. Thank you for debunking the divine clockmaker.
Right, this is why, right, exactly. So
that really confused me when I was younger. And I was like, did God just...
No,
so
God can't. No, since He creates out of nothing, He literally can't just create and walk away, because there's nothing to walk away from outside of his act of creation. Yes.
Have we stepped into theology?
No.
This is still pure philosophy.
For Aquinas, yeah. This distinction. Yes, we've stepped into theology, maybe. How do I put this? No, when you step in theology is when you say, we know for sure that there's creation and not just eternal conservation. That's really when you step in theology. For Aquinas, the mind can conceive of both possibilities, but can't definitively argue anyone just on philosophical grounds. Revelation tells us, for Aquinas, I disagree with him here. I think an eternal past universe is actually impossible and therefore can't be done even by God. I think there's good arguments for that in philosophy. Aquinas doesn't. If you think about the world being dependent on God, the way the Bible teaches it is this, right? That in the beginning, there's a moment when all existence begins, right? That's the moment of first creation, right? And then the universe develops, but it's got to be sustained by God's conservation, as we just explained, because there's nothing there outside of His creation to leave alone. So He creates it with certain natures and certain laws, and it has a certain relative autonomy, but it all depends on His creating it with those natures and those laws and giving it existence, okay? The other possibility would be something like this. God is outside of time, so He's always existed and always will exist. He's not even measured by time, so these hours are kind of funny for Him. And so might it not be possible for Him to always be creating the universe? And instead of the universe beginning in a certain time one, which we call the moment of creation, and ending really never, but it's going to end, this order will end, but something will keep coming. Couldn't it be possible for there to be an infinite past and a potentially infinite future? And God is just always, right, creating / conserving it, but without a first creation in time. Aquinas says either one is possible for God to do, and you cannot argue definitively just with reason for one or the other, but it's been revealed to us that this is the true one. Other philosophers, and I tend to agree with them, say actually no, this entails a kind of impossibility or contradiction. What is that impossibility or contradiction? I'm glad that you asked. Basically, I think if this is true, right, well then in any given moment, there's an infinite series of past moments behind any time one, there's an infinite past behind it, right? But that's real time. That's not just potential time. And so if I go back to like time one minus 8 kajillion, right? Well, behind that that time one minus a gajillion, there's another infinite behind it, right? Because we're talking about no beginning, no temporal beginning. I think that's impossible because you can never have a present, right? You could never get from anywhere to now unless you had a starting point. Thomas doesn't think that they're real moments, but that doesn't make sense to me. I think there has to be some sort of real multitude of continuous moments, right? So I hate to disagree with Thomas, but I just did. I stole it from someone else, though, of course. If you have an original idea, let me know, because they're very valuable. Good. I hope I didn't lose everyone. Did I lose some people? I don't know. Good. Great. So creation is neat, right? Because it's not a change, and it presupposes that God keeps doing it. Example I like to use is, okay, this has the ability by itself and with the table to be there. Right? And there it is. It can stay there. And I can take it and move it over here. Now I'm the cause of it having moved from there to there. But it doesn't need me to continually keep it there. Because in itself, it has the power to stay there. Right? Now, if we talk about here, at least in this universe, in this world, right here, it needs me to hold it there. Because it has no power on its own, right? There's nothing in it which allows it to stay here without my continual holding it here. And if I let it go, I let it go. And then it goes somewhere it can stay by its on its own, right? It's kind of like this sentence. If I speak in the sentence, the printer turns on. No. If I stop speaking this, the sentence stops existing, right? That's like God in creation. It needs it. It there's nothing. There's no thing there that He can just like change and let go, right? There's no power that it has on its own outside of the powers that He gives it. Okay, good. All things visible and invisible. This is very important. It's against heresies that taught that matter was evil. And so people have the experience of like, okay, I know with my mind that I should not drink so much or not eat so much or not do certain things in the era of sexual morality. But my body, like, you know, is against me in those things, right? The flesh wars against the spirit and the spirit wars against the flesh, as St. Paul puts it. So some people, even way before Christianity, right, Pythagoreans and other people, Platonists too, they concluded from that battle between virtue and unruly or concupiscible desires, that matter itself was the problem, right? This is a battle that happens between body and soul. And so they conclude that there must be something evil about bodiliness as such, and not just, you know, our struggle with those things. And so the church says no, no, no. And Revelation says no, no, no. God creates everything. And both visible, right, the sensible realm, and invisible, the spiritual realm, and therefore they're both good. This is against all forms of dualism, in which the spirit is good and has one source, a kind of good God, and matter is evil and has another source, a kind of evil, an evil God. And they're warring against each other in the created order. So that camp fall like Docetists, Gnostics, Manichaeans, among others. Against this, the church constantly teaches the goodness of all creation because it's all from God, who is good, and there's only one source of all that is, right? There's only one God, not two, one bad and one good, right? It's not the force. Now, that doesn't mean we're naive, right? The world is good and human nature is good, but it's fallen because of sin. And so we're in what's called a post-lapsarian state, in which even nature is marred by the effects of sin. Division, illness, antagonism, right? Man versus woman, woman versus man, man versus nature, nation versus nation, right? Violence. And the Bible kind of, in its eschatological visions, puts forth the vision and the hope of a time when these antagonisms will be overcome, right? The lion lies down with the lamb, et cetera, et cetera. And so we have a lot of good things to look forward to in heaven. Thank God. Good. So that's I think the I mean it's clear in the Bible, right, that in Genesis God creates everything and he sees that it's all good, right? He's not like, oh, it's all good except for the matter part. And he says, no, it's all good. And then when he creates us, it's very good, made in his image and likeness. Okay, Almighty. So obviously that's in the Bible, but I think in the fourth century it was important for them to emphasize that visible and invisible, right, all things, because there were many who said, no, the visible is kind of bad and suspect, and the spiritual is really the good side. Okay, that was very much in the air, and still is. Okay. So Almighty or all powerful, real quick. This is a cool concept. We brought it up before. This means that God can do or make anything that is possible to do or to make. The only limit to God's power is what's called the absolutely possible. All powerful, God can do or make anything that can possibly be done or made. All right, so what's the exception? The only exceptions are what we can call logical contradictions or absurdities. And the good news is these are not real things, right? These are not really things. They only seem to be in our speech. So what's an example of this? A squared circle, right? Can God square the circle? No, because it's not a thing to be done, right? It implies a contradiction that a circle would be a circle and not a circle at the same time and in the same respect, or that a square would be a square and not a square in the same time in the same respect. This is very important. It's called the principle of non-contradiction, the PNC. Not the bank, but the principle of non-contradiction, which states very clearly, appears first in Plato, I believe, in the Republic, and then Aristotle makes it more explicit. It states that something, a thing, cannot both be and not be in the same time, at the same time, and in the same way, or in the same respect. So anything that entails a contradiction not only has to be false, but can't exist, right? It just literally can't exist. And so to say that God can't do it is not a limitation of his power, because it's not a thing to be done. It's nothing. It's just words, like a square circle. Or can God make a rock so heavy that he can't lift it? No, because then he wouldn't be God, right? And God can't make himself not God. He can make himself also human, but he can't. But in his divine nature, he can't say, oh, I quit being God, right? Because God has to exist, okay? So God can't cease existing. That doesn't make any sense for the source of all existence not to exist. He has to exist. Yeah. And so, you know, you get these, like this is one of my favorite false syllogisms of all time. It's a little bit irreverent, but we'll close on this philosophical note. How's it go? Nothing is better than God. A peanut butter and jelly sandwich is better than nothing. Therefore, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich is better than God. Okay, that's the false middle or something like that, whatever it's called. In any event, so it's, you know, these things are just tricks, right? They're not real arguments. And they come from not understanding this. So God is all-powerful means that he can do anything that can possibly be done or made. And these exceptions are precisely things that can't be done or made because they literally can't exist because they're absurd and they entail a contradiction within themselves. Now, next time we'll talk about one last thing, putting these... Oh, Father. I wanted to talk about that. We can talk about Father next time and then move into the next to the next article of the Creed. Great. Any last questions? I feel like I've been talking a mile a minute these last 10 minutes. No? Wonderful. No questions?
It's all very clear.
Wow. Usually you have some sort of question that like throws me off. No. Shakes my faith even. Not that bad. Okay. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, hope, handmaid of the Lord.
Pray for us.